We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On this episode, a question of character. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Emma Nicholson and Louise Freeman about some important people in Harry's found family. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
This is another episode in our series devoted to conversations about chapters in our Potterversity companion book of essays. And so this time we are going to get into some deep character analysis about some of the most important members of Harry's found family, Sirius Black, Molly and Ginny Weasley, and Arthur Weasley. Emily, do you have people in your life that you consider found family who have been really important to your personal development?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The family that I come from was enriched by adoption. So that is something that I live
wonderful.
With every day. Yeah, it is wonderful. And I can't imagine life without my brother, and not only my brother, but his family, you know, his wife that he married and then their kids that they have. And so mm-hmm. that's a really wonderful aspect of it. But I also had we had this friend of the family who my mom had roomed with in college, and she had no living relatives, or just one. And then eventually it was her father and he died. And so she had no living relatives. And so we just kind of adopted her into our family. And she was like kind of this crazy cross between a grandma and an aunt and a friend, you know, and she was always the type of mm-hmm. adult who wanted to get on the floor and play with the kids and, you know, and have
the
a really good
kind.
Time.
The best kind,
exactly. She was a big gift giver. So, and we were like her kids. So, mm-hmm. you know, so she was always a lot of fun, very supportive, always there at all the life events. And she died in 2010, and I, you know, I miss her almost every day. And so what about you, Katie? Do you have found family that's close to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was thinking about it. It's so interesting that you say, you know, the people that come to you through marriage and so on, which I think that's one of the things, right? Because Harry's mm-hmm. going to marry into his found family eventually.
Right.
And so when, you know, seeing Jenny as the, you know, the connecting person there. But
yeah.
And so I definitely have really loved being a part of my husband's family.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have sisters. And so I feel like, you know, I have his sisters now.
Oh, that is nice.
Really wonderful.
Yeah.
But I also think I have a lot of friends mm-hmm. who are so, like you were describing, they're so close that I feel like they're really part of our family. And mm-hmm. That's just really invaluable. I have people I consider to be like, you know, like a sister.
Mm-hmm,
You know, and it's like,
yeah,
you know, it's that kind of relationship. It's not always perfect, right? But
right.
you can expect the truth from this person and unquestioning support.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, we have people who are also kind of serving in that aunt friend mm-hmm. role with my kids, who are just invaluable. And I just, you know, the Harry Potter books have this friendship theme that's so mm-hmm. strong. And I do feel like your friends becoming your family is one of the greatest, one of the greatest things that you can have in your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think, and you know, it's a sign that we're all a human family, you know, that even the most distant person from us is actually a family member in some sense. And and that, you know, cuts to the core of my religious beliefs too. So it's a sort of an expression of that.
Absolutely. Well, our guests today are going to help us to gain a richer or perhaps an alternative view of Sirius Black and some of the Weasleys. So joining us to discuss her essay, Padfoot Revelio, The Life and Love of Sirius Black, is our technical editor, Emma Nicholson. Good to have you on this side of the microphone, Emma. When she's not working her magic with the Potterversity podcast, Emma is a business analyst in Sydney, Australia, who has written character deep dives for Archive of Our Own. Plus, she is the co-host of another podcast called Positive Disintegration. And listeners, I think you'll find some really interesting content there. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Katie. It's great to be on the other side of the desk, you know, in front of the microphone.
That's right. Always fun. Of course, we love to hear your Australian voice on our podcast as well. Also joining us is Louise Freeman, a professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University and licensed behavior analyst, a service provider for special needs children. Louise has written a number of articles about Harry Potter and other young adult literature and psychology. Her essay in the Potterversity book is delightfully titled The Weasley Witches, From Snitches to Stitches to Not My Daughter, You Bitches.
Yes! Greatest title ever.
So welcome back to the show, Louise.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here. Always wonderful to talk to you ladies about Harry Potter.
Right back at you. So our third chapter from this section of the book, A Question of Character, is mine, the one that I wrote, called Arthur Weasley and the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts, which takes a closer look at Mr. Weasley, the flying Ford Anglia, and wizard-muggle relations. Also, a little bit about immortality, y'all. So I'm throwing all the things in. So much fun to have everybody on the show talking about all of these people who, you know, become part of Harry's family and are so important to his development and his life. So let's start. How about we all just talk a little bit about what got everybody interested in studying these particular characters?
So the first thing that got me interested in Sirius is that I love him as a character. And I think when you're passionate about something, you always do a little bit better. But the thing I really love about Sirius is his authenticity. So he's never afraid to be who he is, stand up for what he believes in, speak his mind, and he just follows his heart, rules or no rules. I also love that because he lives with his heart, he loves deeply and fiercely. And he's a great example of living with love. And we know that that's the most powerful magic there is in the series. But I think the one thing that really got my interest is that Padfoot's a grey character. You know, he's one of the characters that point out to us as the readers that, you know, the world isn't split into good people and Death Eaters, and there's light and dark in all of us. And his flaws and his challenges and his trauma make him all the more human and deep as a character, because those challenges and flaws that he has, they kind of go against the notion of perfection that we have. And I'm a big believer that imperfections don't make you less. They make you richer and they make you very human, and that human is beautiful. And I think it's one of the themes that, particularly for Harry, isn't dealt with very well, because he tends to go into a tailspin every time someone he assumes is good shows a flaw, like, you know, Dumbledore, when he reads about Dumbledore's history, or he sees Snape's worst memory, and he has his doubts about James. So I think that's why I wanted to tackle Sirius.
You know, I have a sort of a similar story there, because but a little bit on the opposite side, because I think we all just assume Mr. Weasley is good. You know, he comes across as, you know, this idealized father figure. He's a big defender of Muggles. That's his whole job. He invented the Muggle Protection Act to prevent magical mischief against Muggles. And as I was, you know, doing another essay that I was writing about kind of the hidden colonialism in a lot of what J.K. Rowling does, it occurred to me that, maybe, like, he's misusing Muggle artifacts himself quite a bit here, and that's ironic. And So maybe he's doing something that actually looks like intercultural exchange, especially with the Ford Anglia, but is really colonialism, that is really this thing, cultural appropriation. And so I became really struck by this possibility that a good character might be doing something that contributes to Muggle oppression or that is, you know, somehow offensive and wrong. And I was just really interested to try to tease that out a little bit. And what does that mean? So it's a little bit, you know, we can see again that people are not, they're not like purely one way or another. And what happens when we create a little more complexity in Arthur's character, it helps us to understand him better. And I think he becomes a richer character because of that.
Oh, definitely. And listeners, if you're nervous about what Katie is describing about her chapter, if you're a big Arthur Weasley fan, you should just definitely read it, because I think you'll be very satisfied with kind of where she comes down in her argument. It's definitely a chapter that made me appreciate Arthur even more than I already do, which is significant.
So, oh, good. Yeah. No, I love Arthur Weasley, so don't worry about that.
Right. Louise, what about you? What drew you to the Weasley women?
A couple of different things. This was sort of a intersection between a couple of areas of interest. I had written a couple of articles about the theme of nature in Harry Potter, and which included, you know, looking at the Weasleys, particularly looking at Molly as kind of an earth mother archetype. That's what sort of got me into looking more closely into feminine archetypes. Now, keep in mind, you know, my background is in behavioral neuroscience. I currently work as a behavior analyst. I come at psychology very much from an experimental behaviorist's angle. So Jungian archetypes are way out of my comfort zone. I mean, this is the first time I had really read seriously about them. Hmm. And once I got into reading that, I thought, oh, you know, this one really fits Molly well. This one really fits Jenny well. And, you know, the Weasleys are such a unusual family in the wizarding world. I mean, they're a big family. I don't think we have any families that have more than three kids in them anywhere mm-hmm. else. I can't think of any. Mm-hmm. And here's Molly with her seven. And, you know, they got that bright red hair, so they stand out for that reason. They have their purebloods, but they're also poor as opposed to, you know, wealthy the way a lot of their pureblood families are. And, you know, they're supportive and they love Muggles and supportive of Muggle rights. Again, maybe not always in the most culturally appropriate way, but, you know, they certainly are atypical in so many ways. Yet this is the family that Harry connects to when he meets the wizarding world and, you know, really becomes his surrogate family as he is growing up in this different environment. So, and of course, Jenny and Molly are the only women in the family. They're
right.
heavily outnumbered mm-hmm. by the guys. So I thought particularly looking at the female archetypes and how they apply to those would be particularly interesting.
Well, and let me follow up on that and ask, because I feel like Ginny especially is, I don't know if she's misunderstood or if she's just kind of underanalyzed or underappreciated by a lot of people. I've heard the argument a lot that Ginny doesn't have very much of a personality, which, yeah, I'm always like, hey, I think she does, you know. So do you think that these characters are misunderstood, and how do you think your interpretation is different from what others have said about them?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, reading other scholarly work that has been written about Jenny Weasley, I mean, there's a lot out there that really kind of disses her in a way that I don't think she deserves. I mean, she's called a doormat at times, and, you know, the female character who puts aside her own needs in service of Harry's and that type of stuff. And I really think that's an unfair analysis. I think there are a couple of things that make Jenny a little hard for a lot of people to get. Number one, she does not play the typical role of the hero's love interest in mm-hmm. the series for most of the book. That whole, they don't get together until the end of the sixth book. And, you know, we're used to the love interest of the hero being, you know, if not the second lead character in the series overall, at least the most prominent and the most important female character. And of course, so in Harry Potter,
Hermione.
That place is taken by Hermione, who is not a romantic lead. And because that great theme of friendship, particularly the Harry, Ron, Hermione friendship, is so important and so consuming, you know, Jenny kind of gets left out of a lot of things and doesn't quite get the attention that you would expect, you know, the hero's girlfriend to get. She also, of course, changes dramatically. She's a very different kid in Chamber of Secrets than she is in The Half-Blood Prince, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Quite.
You know, she's, you know, people quite rightly say, well, her role in the Chamber of Secrets is to be the damsel in distress that the hero is going to come in and rescue from the spooky dungeon. And that absolutely happens. But, you know, with typical damsel in distress, you know, after she's rescued, you know, either her story is just over, or, you know, you get the sort of the postscript and she marries the hero and they live happily ever after. And that's pretty much the end. Well, Jenny, you know, has, you know, five more books to grow and develop, and is going to go through four books and two more boyfriends before she gets, and that's just not something that happens in a lot of adventure stories, young adult literature, anything like that. They don't waste time going to that very roundabout way to getting the romantic leads together.
There should be more like development of ex-boyfriends among damsels in distress, I think. Yeah. That would be.
Well, you know, and you know, I think this is an incredibly positive thing. I mean, I love that Harry Potter has this wonderful platonic relationship between Harry and Hermione that is mm-hmm. never tinged with romance and right. that type of stuff. It's an unusual thing, and I think it's a great thing. And, you know, so for Jenny, you know, Jenny kind of fades to the background in particularly in Prisoner of Azkaban. I mean, she is almost not there, just like she was almost not there in Sorcerer's Stone. And then she kind of reemerges. And I argue in my essay that one of her kind of reemergent moments is when she goes to the Yule Ball with Neville Longbottom. And, you know, suddenly here's a girl that is potential date material. And she has a chance to go to the Yule Ball with Harry, who she's been crushing on for 2 years. And she had promised Neville and she keeps her word and winds up, mm-hmm. of course, at the Yule Ball. It's when she takes up with Michael Corner, who becomes her first real boyfriend. And she goes from Michael to Dean and has these other relationships and essentially, you know, works as a free agent. She is no longer she's not going to sit around and wait for Harry to notice her. She is going to date. She's going to have fun. She's going to snog. And even if it gets on her brother's nerves.
And she's intentionally doing that to get more experience. Wasn't it like Hermione's advice for her to, you know,
date around?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And turned out to actually be a very good move. I mean, I think both Harry and Jenny needed a little more experience dating before they got together because, you know, neither of them did a particularly good job of it the first go around. And yeah, so, Jenny spends most of Half-Blood Prince crying because she's having trouble with Dean. And of course there's Harry's whole disastrous Valentine's date with Cho. You know, they had to learn a few things before they were ready for, you know, their actual relationship. And that's life. Showing that process is not a bad thing. And, you know, one of the traits of the Amazon archetype in, Tony Wolf's model is that, you know, the Amazon's goal is not having a high prestige partner. She wants to win the laurels herself. And that, I think, is what Jenny does. She, she says she prefers goal scoring to seeking. And yes, she can fill in for Harry as seeker when she's needed, but she'd rather be a chaser, and that's what she does. And I think that's a really, good thing and a strong thing. So, and, you know, the third reason I think people don't appreciate Jenny is because she was, her role was so diminished in the movies. And we just didn't mm-hmm. see a yeah. lot of her best moments in the movies. And that, I think, has hurt the reader's experience of Jenny as well.
Yeah, she just suddenly blows up all the stuff in the Hall of Prophecies and everybody's like, huh, Jenny can do magic.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's like, yeah.
Emma, what about Sirius? In what ways is Sirius misunderstood, and why do you think that is, and what do you have to say about it in your essay?
Well, apart from the what I touched on before about the pros and cons thing of sort of tallying up his good deeds against his not so good deeds, I don't really take that approach to it. I kind of look at what had happened to him, and my technique is normally to take all the details of what has happened with the character and put it into a timeline. So as I went through the phases of Sirius's life, one of the things that stood out to me was his powerful capacity to love. I mean, we talk about Harry and Lily as exemplars of love in the series, but as I went through looking at Sirius, I realized how powerful his love is as well throughout the series. And I think that's one of his aspects that is very sort of underread by a lot of people, because particularly when you consider how trodden on and abused he had been, mm-hmm. how much trauma that he had suffered, he's still fiercely loving, generous. Despite the fact the entire wizarding world basically did wrong by him, he's still fully prepared to fight what is right and defend the wizarding world.
Yeah, and Emma, one of the things that I think is so powerful about your essay is that it really brings home all of the trauma that Sirius experienced. It's not like he had this charmed life and then all of a sudden he's in Azkaban. Like, he's experiencing all kinds of troubles earlier on because mm-hmm. he's the odd man out within his own family. And, you know, he's kind of emancipating himself from his family early on. And we know that he has layers of trauma. And yet when you interpret his actions in the light of that, it's just all the more powerful, that sense of his loving nature.
Right. And unlike Harry, he didn't have somebody charm his blood at the age of one, you know, so that he mm-hmm. could be sort of, you know, either immune or protected from the hate that surrounded him in his own family. And I think that that's particularly striking in what you bring up.
Absolutely. And I think that is one thing that some readers, particularly younger readers who haven't seen hardship firsthand, might not really absorb from his character is, you know, how damaging and long lasting the effects of traumatic experiences like that can be through someone's adult life. But he had, you know, an abusive, a verbally abusive childhood. He ran away, lived on his own from a young age. And Azkaban, like, when you actually read into what Azkaban is like, because remember, it's a bit like in Canto when we don't talk about Bruno, we don't talk about Azkaban. No one wants to mention the Dementors or what it's like in Azkaban. Right. So we don't get a lot of details. But when you look into it, the gravity of how cruel and callous and horrible that place is, it's amazing that he came out, you know, sane, let alone, you know, with any love still in his heart. But the fact that he can still love so fiercely is nothing short of a miracle.
Wow. And that, you know, I don't know, I'm more of a cat person than a dog person. But I know this sounds unrelated, but just what you're saying, but I mean, this is like what people say about dogs, like the benefit of dogs is that they just know how to love their people so well. And I feel like she has tied that into the character in this really subtle way that you would not even notice, but it kind of goes along with his dog personality as well. Am I crazy? Is that a thing?
I don't think you're crazy at all.
Yeah.
And what do you think about when you think about dogs? Love and loyalty.
Right.
And that pretty much sums him up.
Right.
And one of the things, Emma, that you also highlight is sort of similar to what Louise was saying about, you know, Jenny's like not in the movies. And so we don't get much about her from that venue. In the books, Harry doesn't actually know all that much about Sirius. And so we don't know all that much about him. And that's why what you're doing and kind of piecing all of this together from little clues scattered about, you know, helps us, because it prevents the, you know, as we as readers, we're just taking in Harry's perspective, and Harry doesn't seem to know very much.
Right.
No, and everything he sees is, you know, as a teenager, but he spends so much time at Hogwarts, like particularly with adult characters who lived a long life before he even came along. You know, we don't see a lot of them. Then he goes off to Hogwarts and he's away from them for extended periods of time. And it's only really when he's in the holidays that we sort of see anything of them or if they correspond with him. So there's that sort of issue to grapple with, is that there's very little detail often to go from.
Right. Katie, what about Arthur? How do you think people misunderstand Arthur Weasley, and what do you think stands in the way of their seeing him more clearly?
Well, I think it goes back to what I was saying before, and that, you know, the world, I believe, right now especially, is sadly lacking in our appreciation of nuance and complexity. This idea that people are not going to be purely good or purely bad. I think there's this tendency in our polarized world to put people in one category or the other. And this is related to what Emma was saying before, good people and Death Eaters, you know. But the best of Rowling's characters demonstrate that there is complexity. And Mr. Weasley is a good example of this, I think, because he's so wonderful that a lot of us, we don't pay any attention to the fact that he's doing questionable things. And then when you do start to pay attention to it, you actually can't just then cast Mr. Weasley as this dirty cultural appropriator whose every action is suspect, because his character is so good.
Right.
And so I think it's a really good challenge. And it reminds us that people are a mix. We're all flawed. And you have to appreciate people, who people are on balance. You know, the good and the bad, the misinformed, the ignorant, the clumsy, the trying, though you don't always get it right. You know, the heart's in the right place kind of thing. And that's what the world is full of. I think that's just such an important lesson for us in this particular moment, that I just find that a real plus to doing this kind of character analysis.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Because all of these characters are really critical to Harry's own emotional development. Mm-hmm. So what do we think is the impact of each of these characters on Harry's character arc?
Yes. You know, the Weasleys are Harry's adopted family. And they're really his model for how people should behave in a functioning family structure. He doesn't have that from living with the Dursleys. You know, he just has dysfunction there. And so when he interacts with the Weasleys, he's learning about family. He's also learning about how wizards view non-magical people by looking at Arthur. And ultimately, Harry, as a half-blood, is welcomed into the pure-blood Weasley family, along with Hermione, of course. And I think this kind of fusion of the so-called pure-bloods with people who have at least one foot in the Muggle world is a really important statement about the importance of diversity and cultural intermingling in the series. And this is something that Harry gets from his association with the Weasleys. He understands the kind of insular nature of the wizarding world, but he also, you know, understands the importance of actually not being that way, and diversity and variety and people who are not, you know, quote unquote, pure, because so much of that is related to how people get oppressed.
Yeah, that's true. Louise, what about the Weasley women? How do you think that they factor into Harry's character arc?
Well, I mean, in the case of Molly, I mean, she is, you know, her love is maternal. I mean, there's just, it's mother all the way. I mean,
absolutely. When
you, I think you see this mostly, I mean, it's clearest in Goblet of Fire, when, you know, after the tournament, Molly has come, she's substituted for Harry's family, you know, to be there at the final task for him. He has this traumatic event in the graveyard where he sees Cedric Diggory murdered. And, you know, at the end, Molly, you know, puts the potion bottle down and just takes him into her arms and hugs him. And it's one of the most beautiful and also one of the saddest parts of the book, where you think about this 14-year-old kid. He never, ever remembers being hugged like that, as if by a mother.
Right.
And this is the first mother's hug he can remember getting. And
yeah,
it comes,
I think,
from Molly.
That phrase, as if by a mother, I think is such a powerful one.
Yes, it's like, as it's not a mother, it's as if this was a mother. It's like it's still a foreign concept to mm-hmm. him that a mother could love you. And of course, you know, going back to what Emma has said, this protective, strong, nurturing love of Molly's is what puts her in conflict with Sirius at times, in terms of, you know, there's the arguments they have in Order of the Phoenix, where, you know, Sirius wants to tell Harry what's going on with the Order and what's going on with Voldemort, and Molly wants to shield him from that. And there's a bit of a tug of war between those two in terms of who has Harry's best interest at heart. And of course, they both do. Molly, very motherly instincts to protect and shield. Sirius is, you know, much more of the, yes, I love you, I support you, but you deserve to know the truth. And we're not going to hide the truth from you, you know, as far as what's going on, because we know you're involved with it. You're the one Voldemort's trying to kill.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting, Louise, is you and Emma, your chapters both look at that exact scene in terms of mm-hmm. Harry's, you know, like parental or mentoring relationships. And so it's really interesting to, you know, hear it analyzed from the Molly Weasley side and also from the Sirius Black side.
Which Molly's totally in the wrong. I mean, that's fine. Oh. It's one of the things I love about her, that she's trying to nurture Harry despite, because even Molly's flaws make her completely motherly. If you notice in that scene, both Arthur and Remus decline to back Molly up and like, yeah, serious wins.
Right.
Sorry, is the legal guardian. Harry is old enough.
In the essay where Tony Wolfe describes these feminine archetypes, she mentions, you know, the positive and negative aspects of both of those. And the negative aspect of the mother is, you know, being overly protective, to project her own wants and needs on her child or her childlike figure, and thereby, you know, keeping the child from developing and growing into their own person. And I think we do see that with Molly. I mean, you know, both at that scene in Order of the Phoenix, where she's, you know, trying to shield him then. And then, you know, later on in Deathly Hallows, when they're preparing right. for the wedding and she's trying to keep the trio separated, trying to prevent them from doing this, saying, no, you can't, Dumbledore can't possibly have given you this mission, that you must be misunderstanding. You know, by the end of it, you know, Lupin accepted, yes, these three have to go off and do this. Arthur accepted it. Molly never did accept that this was going to happen. And had she been successful, it really was only Hermione's brilliance and, you know, packing that beaded bag early and keeping it with her during the wedding that really let them even start out with anything less than a disaster on that mission when the Death Eaters, you know, break up the wedding.
And which you can understand her worry, though, in that circumstance, because it's so dangerous. But the thing I love is the super petty giving Hermione an Easter egg the size of a chicken's egg because she read something that Rita Skeeter wrote about a love triangle between her, Harry, and Crumb.
Yeah. I think, it shows, yes, that even, you know, as beautiful as motherly love is, and of course, it's one of the most powerful forces in the entire series between Lily's sacrifice and Molly, and that, you know, Molly taking down Bellatrix and Narcissa, protecting Harry at the end for Draco's sake and all this type of stuff. But yes, there's a negative side to overprotectiveness and exclusive motherly love in the series as well.
What about Sirius, right? We're on to Sirius about Harry's emotional arc, Harry's character arc. Emma, what do you think?
Vernon was really the father figure that Harry should have had, but didn't. The Dursleys failed spectacularly in their parenting endeavors of him. And Sirius was also, in a way, the father that Harry should have had through circumstance. So he was named godfather, but never got the opportunity to carry that out. And I like to compare those two because Vernon had all these years with Harry. He should have loved him and should have understood him, and absolutely doesn't. So he had all of the time and none of the care, whereas Sirius is the exact opposite. He has all of the care. He understands Harry in a way that the other characters don't, because he grew up in that similar sort of abusive upbringing. He understands the judgment and the mislabeling from the wizarding community, and he loves Harry so much, but he just has hardly any time with him, sadly. But we see the result of that is that Harry is so devoted to Sirius in a way that he's really not to other characters in the series, to the point where Creature goes and tattles to Narcissa and says that Harry is starting to view Sirius as a mixture of father and brother, even though it's only been a couple of years.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I think is really interesting, and you can already hear it in our conversation here, is that there's this really important kind of gender dynamic that's happening in terms of these found family members and Harry. And I think about Arthur being this idealized father figure for Harry that is exceptionally important to him as well, and as somebody who is still there, right? We know Rowling almost killed him off, but then decided maybe I shouldn't kill off arguably the best father in the series.
Yeah.
But he embodies a kind of male British stereotype in the form of the tinkerer, the slightly eccentric fellow who's inventing things in his shed. And I talk about that some in my chapter. I make a brief comparison of him to Caractacus Potts, who I know you all know is the father in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And
of course,
Caractacus Potts, even with the name, there are all these interesting intersections with Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
But yeah, that's totally a wizard name.
Yeah. He also invents this heroic and perhaps sentient car, like the Flying Fort Anglia.
Oh, yeah.
And he's also this kind of ideal father type and tinkerer, and they're bound up together in a kind of male out of house idea that I think it seems distinctly British to me, part of the, you know, the British children's lit tradition. And one of the things I think is interesting about Arthur that's shaded, just like Louise, you were talking about with Molly, right? And her motherly qualities. And actually, Emma, you were saying this too, her motherly qualities are, you know, they can also have these negative aspects. Arthur is paternalistic in his approaches, not only to the kids, but also toward muggles. That's the part, that's the problematic bit, right? His paternalism reeks of a kind of colonial superiority in some ways that are not ideal. You know, he doesn't know enough about them to be able to approach them in a way that's, you know, that's really equalizing.
And he's embarrassing.
Yeah, right.
In his approach, when he's like talking to the Grangers, and you know, it's you kind of feel the cringiness of the whole scene.
Yeah, and also, how about all the memory modification he's probably having to do on muggles?
Oh my!
Right, that's a whole thing. I always find the memory modification is just like a quagmire over there that I feel like we have to sort of. Because the books don't consider it all that important, but like the significance of modifying muggle memories because they've encountered, you know, a bewitched object. And he just must be doing that a lot in his job.
Right.
And that's kind of colonialist. It's got that. Again, it's this kind of paternalist. We know better. And we have to try to, you know, protect people for their own good, even when it's not with their knowledge. So I just see kind of a similar kind of problematic aspect to the gendered nature of his, you know, of his relationship with Harry. What do you all think about this, you know, this issue of gender and the role that it plays?
I have thoughts about Arthur on that.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing that's typically fatherly and has to do with modifying memories is his own memory. Because every time Fred and George do something wrong, he's like, oh, don't tell your mother you're gambling. I don't want to bring up the tun-tun toffee in front of Molly because she's just going to shout and I can't be bothered dealing with this because you know, he gets to a point where he's just like, I don't want to know because I can't be bothered dealing with the fallout in my own house. I've heard Molly shout too many times. I can't be bothered. I don't want to know.
Yeah. Don't tell Molly. Don't tell Molly. I bewitched the trunk so that it's a never ending trunk.
Yeah,
just don't tell Molly.
Tell Molly.
Right. That's so funny. Louise, what about Ginny? Because it seems like that there's a lot of pitfalls surrounding Ginny and the way she's perceived based on her gender.
Well, I mean, this is, of course, is part of her issues with growing up the only girl in a family with six brothers. And, you know, the fact that, you know, they wouldn't let her play Quidditch with them. And you know, she had to sneak the brooms out of the shed and practice on her own if she wanted to get any good at Quidditch and things like that. I think there's also some issues, you know, between Jenny and Molly in terms of their butting heads, which they do quite frequently over the course of the book in terms of you know, whether it's Molly asking Jenny to do chores that she didn't ask the boys to do. And of course, her whole deal in terms of trying to keep Jenny out of the battle as well. You know, I think as far as Harry goes, Harry is, you know, he is protective of her in terms of, you know, needing to shield her from the danger. You know, he never considers taking her with them on their camping trip and stuff like that. Part of it, of course, is she's underage still. And so he can't. And but, you know, he does want her to stay safe in the room of requirement during the battle. But guess what? You know, as soon as she gets a chance, she's out of there and she runs off after Tonks and is fighting on her own terms after that. She doesn't, you know, actually follow his directions that often in terms of staying safe and staying out of danger. And so I think, you know, for Harry, he has to learn to, you know, let her be who she is going to be. You know, people, you know, say that, you know, I think it's her when she steps out on her own, when she's dating other guys, when she's playing Quidditch and that type of stuff, that is when Harry starts to really feel attracted to her. And I think her autonomy and her independence and her kind of standing on her own two feet is really what makes her appealing to him as a character, and which is, you know, I think a very good thing overall in terms of, you know, eventually being a healthy relationship for the two of them.
Yeah. One of the things I like about your essay, Louise, and there's so many things to like, is that you talk about how it's like Jenny's the Amazon and Molly is the mother. You actually talk about how they kind of even interchange roles. They develop in the other's direction by the end of the series in the Battle of Hogwarts itself.
Yes. Yes. You know, it's interesting because of course there's the great, you know, not my daughter, you bitch scene where Molly takes down Bellatrix.
Right.
And everybody loves it. Everyone remembers it. It was portrayed beautifully in the movie. You know, this type of stuff. So that's, you know, Molly, that maternal figure has now become the warrior. And so, you know, you've gone from this overly protective mother to this, you know, kind of mother bear protecting the cubs. You will never touch our children again type thing, which everybody is cheering, which is great. But there's another scene in the Battle of Hogwarts that I think gets forgotten. It was never going to make the movie. It was not exciting enough for the movie version of the Battle of Hogwarts, where, you know, Harry and Voldemort were throwing each other off buildings and the like.
Well, you can't compete with that.
Yeah. Right. No, but, you know, the last living person Harry sees before he takes off into the forest to meet his death is Jenny. And she is walking around outside the castle. She has come across a girl who is injured. We don't know this girl's name. It just says that she is crying for her mother. And she's saying, I want to go home. I don't want to fight anymore. And Jenny approaches her. She says, it's all right. We'll get you back to the castle. And Harry's, you know, watching this as under his invisibility cloak, you know, wanting to speak to her, wanting to make himself known, but knowing he can't. And then what happens is Jenny doesn't try to take her back to the castle. She winds up just kneeling beside her and taking her by the hand and sitting there. And, you know, there are a number of different ways of interpreting this, but one strong possibility, I think, is that this girl is grievously injured, dying, you know, perhaps already dead. Why Jenny didn't move her to the castle. And so here we've got this wounded young woman crying for her mother, and Jenny is the one who steps up, kneels, and takes her by the hand. So we see, just as Molly had stepped into that kind of warrior mode, Jenny has actually, at this last sight that Harry sees before he takes off into the woods, kind of stepped into that mother role. And, you know, again, I saw some people kind of diss this, you know, someone described this as, you know, Jenny is being reduced from soldier to field nurse here, which kind of underestimates the importance of field nurses and the bravery of field nurses, in my opinion.
No kidding.
I think that kind of misses the point. You know, Tony Wolfe, you know, argues that part of women's psychological development is first embracing and accepting, understanding your primary archetype, and then gradually incorporating elements of other ones. And for reasons that are a bit too complicated to go into in terms of Wolf's model, the mother and the Amazon are two that readily should be able to understand each other. And so I think that is what is happening in the Battle of Hogwarts, is you have Molly incorporating this warrior aspect of her personality, Jenny actually incorporating some of this maternal aspects of hers. You know, at the very end, again, the last that we see of Jenny, she's just sitting there with her head on Molly's shoulder. So we see these two who have been butting heads quite a bit throughout the series. You know, they have come together to comfort each other in their grief, because of course they've lost Fred, they've lost other people that they care about, but they are understanding each other. I think, you know, Molly hopefully at this point understands why Jenny had to fight, why Harry had to fight, why they did have to do this mission. Jenny, I think, is in a position to understand why her mother was worried, why her mother did try to keep her out of the battle. I mean, she saw not only Fred die, but she may very well have sat by the side of this other girl who died and just offered that comfort when there's nothing else that you can offer.
It also shows how much Ginny has taken after Molly, not only in the fact that she has that nurturing capability, but we finally see, where did Ginny get her formidable fighting skills from? Mm-hmm. Molly, you know, when they're talking about in the fight with Bellatrix, the ground became hot and cracked under the witch's feet, you know, and Ginny's such a powerful, you know, spellcaster. We finally see the similarity between the two, even though they'd seem so opposite. So in that moment of inversion, you go, she is like a mother.
Emma, finally, about Sirius, how do you think gender plays a role in the way that he's interpreted and maybe misinterpreted?
It's funny with Sirius, because I think he shares something with Hagrid in this regard, in that his gender kind of clouds his nurturing side a little, or it's kind of reduced in a way, because Hagrid sort of, you know, he has his flowery apron and his pink umbrella, and you know, he calls himself mummy when he's raising baby Norbert. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So there's that kind of twist on it. But with Sirius, his nurturing stuff kind of goes under the radar because he spends all this time writing to Harry, going into fireplaces and risking himself to spend time with Harry and, you know, always corresponding and saying, you know, keep your nose clean and, you know, stay on the right path and sending him gifts and being as godfatherly as he possibly can. But you're nurturing him emotionally insofar as that because Harry and Sirius sort of understand each other well, Harry writes to him with stuff that he'd never sort of tell other people.
Absolutely.
So when Harry's scars hurting, he's like, who do I write to? Do I write to Hermione? Do I write to Ron? No, I write to Sirius. So he shares those deep fears. So where Molly is physically nurturing to Harry, Sirius is that emotional nurturing. And the other thing that I think is really curious about that is that it is picked up by the fans. So we get that Wolfstar ship in the fandom, you know, everybody thinking that the love between Remus and Sirius, that gets picked up as either a gay or bisexual relationship, which I'm not at all upset by. But I think it's very funny that that deep love between those two men, where in the case of James and Sirius, it's seen as a brotherly relationship. Now with Remus and Sirius, it's seen as a sexualized or some sort of paternal relationship involving Harry, which, you know, when you think about people who have fought alongside each other in wars, it's not uncommon for them, you know, for veterans to have very strong bonds with the people that they fight alongside, and particularly, you know, when they grew up as brothers with James. But it, when you put Harry into the mix, all of a sudden you get that sort of parental child relationship, it flips the relationship, particularly when it comes to fanfic.
No, that is interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I always find the slash fan fiction really interesting, especially the ones that people become that are so often represented that they become almost like, well, everybody knows Remus and Sirius, right? Right. So I just find that really interesting. There must be something about that relationship that, you know, people are drawn to and people are interested in finding out more. I agree. It's got a really interesting gender dynamic.
One of the ideas all the essays play with is all three of your essays is the issue of conformity, whether it's to gender expectation, Wizarding World laws, or social taboos against intermixing with muggles. So what should readers take away from these characters that you've written about where the pressure to conform comes from and how to deal with it?
Well, Arthur is so very, very much a wizard. He lives this kind of insular life among wizards, but he's not a conformist, interestingly. He doesn't mm-hmm. conform to the pure blood ideology, even as it takes over. And he's always thinking beyond the, you know, the structures of the life that he knows, even though he doesn't venture out as much as we think he potentially could. Like he could get to know some muggles, you know?
Right. You can just like walk up the street like the twins do, you know, like they flirt with that girl in the shop.
Yeah. But even from his own, you know, really kind of a closed off world, he's always thinking, is what we're doing a good thing? Do I agree with this part of what my society's doing? If I can't change the structure, how can I fight against it? Even in underground ways. Think about the way that he stays at the Ministry of Magic, but he's working against
right.
Pious Thickness and all that's happening there at the ministry.
Yes. It's a dangerous thing to do, to be honest.
Yes, right. So he stays within and he's always aware that there are other ways to do and be and appreciate them, though he stays within. And actually that fits with one of the things that I talk about in my chapter. I talk about different sort of shades or variations of cultural appropriation, the variety of kinds of practices that fit into that. And I suggest that what Arthur does is more like strategic anti-essentialism, which is a mouthful of a word. And it mostly means that you, from within your own position, you try to sort of adopt some of the ways of oppressed people as a way to value and honor them. That is itself a kind of expression of solidarity. And so he's not at risk of conforming to muggle ways, right? He's going to continue to see them as outside, but he's going to use his connections there to express a love of difference and to try to act upon it structurally even, so that he's actually doing things to resist the conforming pressures of, you know, that what, you know, the way the ministry becomes in book 5, 6, 7, right? So I think the fact that he's even putting his nonconformity into action is extremely powerful.
Absolutely. He knows what it's like to be an outlier, right? Because he's poor.
Yeah. Yeah. He's poor and he's quirky. You know, he's mm-hmm. he is interested in these muggles. He can't let that go. He finds them fascinating and you know, yeah.
The plugs are really cool.
The electricity, right. I know. Louise, how do the Weasley women teach us about conformity and nonconformity?
Molly, of course, I think values conformity to a certain degree. She has her ideas about how things should be. And when things mm-hmm. do not go that way, it does not make her happy. You know, she's not happy when Fred and George drop out of school and go open their joke shop. You know, she wants them to go into a more respectable career. Mm-hmm. She wants, you know, Bill to marry a nice British witch, not this part Vila girl from France who Molly considers, you know, very, very shallow and not worthy of her son, at least at the beginning. But, you know, what I think is neat about Molly is that when she can accept things not going according to her vision, when it's clear that they're succeeding in this, you know, she has that wonderful scene where she reconciles with Fleur after Bill's been injured. And she realizes that, no, I've misjudged this young woman. She's not as shallow and superficial. She's as I thought she was. She's, you know, still wants to marry Bill after he's disfigured. Once the twins actually are successful in their joke shop, she is willing to go to the joke shop and, you know, enjoy the fruits of their success with them.
Right.
And
accept their lavish gifts.
Accept their lavish gifts. Yes. The diamond hat and the necklace and all this type of stuff. Yeah. He admits, you know, yeah, okay. They have a knack for this. And so that is part of her. So, you know, I think she, you know, like the typical mother, you know, values conformity to the rules, values following the rules. You know, she doesn't want them forming the illegal defense society and that type of stuff. But, you know, she can accept things when she needs to. And when she sees that, okay, yes, this is the way to go. And
I really relate to that, Louise.
Yeah.
I'm seeing shades of myself in this.
Yeah. I think it's actually a really good model because she kind of relinquishes rather easily, you know, in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, it only takes a little bit of a sign from Fleur that she's actually a little bit deeper than she looks, mm-hmm. and views Bill more deeply than it might appear, for Molly to kind of come along, you know, you know, she's still nervous about what the twins are doing, but the energy around their business, you know, really inspires her as well. And so I think it's a great example for us moms out there who do resist the less conformist choices.
Yeah. And of course, Jenny, you know, her conforming to expectations is, I think, a major part of her growth in terms of, you know, again, she kind of bucks the expectations all along, you know, when she's breaking into the shed and stealing the brooms when she's 6 years old and learning to fly, even though her brothers, you know, won't let her do that. Yeah, I mean, Jenny is, you know, she really kind of embraces that Fred and George aspect of her personality as she gets older. She becomes, you know, kind of takes over for them, and we increasingly see her, you know, doing the he got off dance and stuff like that, and joining in their pranks, joining in their umbrage baiting, that type of stuff. As she gets older, she's like the twins. She's never a prefect, you know, whereas Bill, Charlie, Percy, and Ron even were. So I think she has that certain disregard for the rules. Again, that she has in common with Harry. which is important for her. And
yeah. And one of the things I think is interesting there is I wondered about the role of that trauma in the Chamber of Secrets in giving her a sense that she's been altered. She's going to be different. There's in a way she's able to make that a strong core of herself that enables her to even give advice to Harry with the Half-Blood Prince's, you know, chemistry book.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, she clearly has, you know, that long-term effect of this. You know, one of the few things she does in Prisoner of Azkaban is when the Dementors come into the Hogwarts Express, her reaction is almost as bad as Harry's. She doesn't faint, but she's shaking. And as they said, she's looking as nearly as bad as Harry felt. Mm-hmm. And I think that trauma, you know, that she has experienced Voldemort's mind up close and shared his mind in the way that only Harry, you know, has left her with that vulnerability to Dementors that is very similar to him. And of course, yes, she does sort of, you know, tell Harry, get over yourself. You're not being possessed. I've been possessed. And yeah, if you can remember where you are and aren't waking up covered with bloody chicken feathers, you're not being possessed. So quit.
It's a high bar.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. And, you know, and you said earlier that she was never a prefect, but mm-hmm. what's interesting is that she does take upon herself a leadership role in her seventh year, in her sixth year, when Harry and the rest are gone. You know, she does take on the leadership role with Neville of, you know, instigating
rebellion.
They try to steal Gryffindor's sword. You know, they're up to all these things with the Karrows, you know, and it's clear that she's not a prefect because, you know, you basically have to be a Death Eater to be a prefect that year. But, you know, she is a leader in this in Dumbledore's army still.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think that is very important. I've always wanted to wish we had a glimpse into what actually went on in Hogwarts that year. I would love to see Neville and Jenny and Luna, you know, thwarting the Karrows.
That would be a fascinating movie. Yeah. That would be or book, you know, but that would be really fascinating. So Emma, there's got to be lessons about conformity and nonconformity in the character of Sirius. Go.
Absolutely. You're talking about one of the most nonconformist people in the series.
Right.
His entire family were like this pure blood, all for, you know, the purification of the wizarding race, all Slytherins, and he just went, don't care. You know, family hates muggles, don't care. You know, I'm going straight for the Modewikes and all the muggle technology. Family's all in Slytherin, don't care. Gets on the Hogwarts Express, I don't want to be sorted into Slytherin. You know, rules at Hogwarts, don't care. He just, every turn, he just doesn't care about what is expected of him and he just does his own thing, which I think is a great example for everybody, but particularly for Harry, because as we know, the Dursleys just try and squash the magic out of him at every turn.
Right.
And I think the lesson in that is twofold. You know, when we look at the Fantastic Beasts movies in particular, we're shown the danger of what can happen when you try to squash the magic or the authenticity out of young people. Credence Bare Bones develops an obscurus. We know what happens when you try to suppress people, and that becomes very dark and very destructive, and there's a good chance that they won't survive that. And if you have young people in your life and they are not conforming to what society expects, so maybe they're LGBTQ, maybe they're neurodivergent or in a minority, or maybe they're gifted, or perhaps they're just a little bit creative and quirky like Luna. For those kids that are trying to grapple with their authenticity and they're trying to resolve the fact that they're different to what society expects, there's pressure on them and it can be heavy, and they can often end up masking themselves or living a lie or squashing that in. And I suggest that everybody be a little bit more like Sirius and embrace authenticity, acknowledge we all have light and dark and quirkiness inside of us, and let the young Harrys of the world be who they truly are.
And yeah, I love that that's coming from an adult, right? Because, you know, like you can see, yes, Luna is quirky and we could be more like Luna, right? But you've got an adult who's living it and who's telling you, yes, it's okay. And this is actually a good way to be.
And if you look at Sirius, his relationships, okay, yes, that authenticity, it may cost him some things. So he refused to bend for society, and as a result, not everybody likes him. But the loving relationships that he does have are built on his authentic self, and therefore they are as solid as a rock. So if you're faced with that dilemma, know that, yes, if you be your authentic self, there is a chance that you may lose some things or some people around you in your life, but the pain of loss will lessen over time, but regret will always burn hotter. And the older that you get and the less that you live as your authentic self, the more you will regret it until you get to the end of your life and say, wow, I wish I'd been more me. So look to Sirius and understand that even as an adult, you can be quirky and different and just not care.
Yeah. And he goes out the way he would have wanted to go out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a life well lived.
Defending the people he loves, right? Mm-hmm. It's particularly Harry.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even in that choice, you know, he was nonconformist, because even Dumbledore was like, oh, we don't want you to do that. Keep yourself out of danger. And people didn't understand it. But it was his choice, and it was in line with who he was inside and how he felt in his heart.
Right. And that's how you know he was really a Gryffindor. He had that kind of, it's a kind of a nonconformist type of bravery, but it is bravery in the end, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Emma and Louise, for joining us on the show today. I feel like there was such good synchronicity in these topics. So interesting, important to think about.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to enjoy these conversations with you all.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's been an absolute blast.
And listeners, I just want to emphasize to you that we have only just touched the surface of these chapters. And I'm just going to tell you, Emma, in her chapter, has a really interesting theory about how it was that Sirius was able to survive Azkaban with his, you know, sanity intact. And you will definitely want to read that. Louise has a fascinating bit where she explains the significance of Molly Weasley's Christmas sweaters. It's genius theory.
I love that part.
It's wonderful. I have a bit where I compare the Flying Ford Anglia to Voldemort's creation of Horcruxes. And if you want to know how those relate, you gotta read the chapter. I don't have the 20 minutes here to explain that. But lots of really good stuff that we didn't even touch on. But I love this conversation because I think it really gets to the humanity of these characters and how we can relate to them. So listeners, check out the full chapters by picking up our Potterversity book, and then let us know what you think. We are always interested to hear from our listeners. Now, although I was tempted to end this episode with Mr. Weasley's provocative question, what exactly is the function of a rubber duck? We are instead going to let the prisoner of Azkaban, Sirius Black, have the last word. He said, "The world isn't split between good people and Death Eaters. We've all got light and dark within us. What matters is the part we choose to act on. That's who we really are."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Towel, featuring Sean Ellsbund, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsbund. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.